She went through. They're lucky she didn't emerge a cowardly basket case. No one would blame her if she were. What are you doing? Tess asks now. Where are you going? She asks Tess in return, because it's easier than explaining that she's waiting to call Mike and tell him that something very strange and frightening showed up in the mail over the past few days. Which day, she hasn't a clue. She hopes it won't matter later. She hopes this was just another prank sent by another loser belatedly coming out of the woodwork. We're going for a run, Tess explains. Cam doesn't have to ask who the other half of we is. It's freezing out, Tess. Cam bends over to wipe the spattered coffee from the floor with the sleeve of her terry cloth robe, which is already covered in baby spit up and going into the dirty clothes hamper anyway. The physical therapist said that running is good for my leg, as long as I stretch before and after. True enough. You wanted me to get up early. Also true, but you didn't even eat breakfast. And the world is full of crackpots, and some of them are dangerous. You know you're not supposed to eat right before you run, Mom. She does know. Not that she's been doing much running lately. She probably should be. She has another 20 pounds of baby weight to shed. Apparently, it doesn't come off without a struggle when one is pushing 40. When she said as much to Dr. Advani at the last checkup, the OBGYN reminded Cam, you're only 37. Be patient. It'll come off. Maybe. Right now, she has other things to worry about, and having Tess out of the house for a while might be a good thing. Go ahead, she says. Be careful. I'm always careful, Mom. Yes, she is. Now, she learned the hard way. Cam listens to Tess leave, and the house settles again. Not a sound but the hum of the refrigerator in the next room and the mantel clock ticking away the minutes. It's still too early to call Mike, but not Lucinda. Cam dials her apartment and gets the voicemail. Lucinda, it's Cam. I need to talk to you. Call me when you get this. She hangs up, tries Lucinda's cell. Voicemail again. She leaves the same message. Uneasy, she hangs up the phone and reaches into the pocket of her robe, making sure it's still there. That she didn't imagine it. No, still there. A photocopy of Ava's obituary, and block lettering scrawled across it. I know what happened to her. Solve it, and if you are right, you will find me. Yes, it could be yet another crank, yet another one who can't spell very well at that. But call it a psychic impression, call it paranoia. Something about this note feels different to Cam. Maybe it's the timing, coming months after the media coverage of Ava's case. Or maybe it's the unsettling fact that the note wasn't typewritten, or even done in ink. No, it appears to have been written, oddly enough, in red lipstick. Chapter 4. The sky hangs low and bleak over Long Beach Island today. Wisps of mist waft in the air like wraiths drifting about a midnight graveyard. Down beyond the dunes at the end of the block, the windswept sea reminds Lucinda of a child's crayon scratch art, hints of purplish blue and greenish-gray color barely visible beneath a black surface. Randy's house, a low, gray-shingled ranch, gives off an air of desertion, not unlike neighboring cottages that have been obviously abandoned for the winter. But here, there are signs of off-season life, storm windows, a shovel and a bucket of ice melt on the step beside the front door, several newspapers wrapped in mud-spattered blue plastic bags sit ominously at the end of the driveway, behind a Toyota bearing a New Jersey license plate that reads RBNME. Obviously, a vanity plate. But it takes a moment for Lucinda to find the presence of mind to decipher it. RBNME? O. RBNME, as in RB, N, me. Randy Barraquette and me. Carla's car. Lucinda parks behind it. Randy, who once drove a Jeep with the top down and music blaring, drives a dark-colored sedan these days. Lucinda knows this because she's ridden in it, but only on official business, when they were looking into the disappearances on Long Beach Island. Sitting beside him in the front seat last summer, with the radio playing, not blaring, but loud enough, and the windows rolled down and the salt air in her hair, she was sometimes tempted to close her eyes and pretend, just for an instant, that they were involved in something other than police work. But she never really let herself do it. Nor did she take Randy up on his invitation for her to come stay here with him and his wife when she checked out of the less-than-comfortable Beach Haven bed and breakfast. "Don't you think that would be a little awkward?" she asked him at the time. "For whom?" Carla doesn't know. "For you," she told him. "For me." "I wouldn't feel awkward at all," he informed her. Ouch. Apparently that meant he was over Lucinda. Or so she assumed at the time. Randy wrote down his address and home phone number for her before they parted ways the day he invited her to stay. "In case you change your mind," he said. "I won't," she said, pocketing it anyway. And she didn't. Not long after, though, she came to realize that she wasn't the only one harboring old feelings. Nor was she the only one behaving herself despite them. What would she have done if Randy had thrown caution to the wind and made a pass at her? She doesn't like to think about that. When she allows herself to, she concludes that she's only human, and if he had made a pass, she might not have resisted him. But he didn't. Which, ironically, only makes him more attractive. Integrity. She respects that quality in a man. He's not going to cheat on his wife. Good for him. Good for her. Good for Carla. Carla. Fighting the urge to back out of Randy's driveway and speed back to Philadelphia, she turns off the engine and looks at Carla's car. So she's at home. Why hasn't she answered the phone? Lucinda tried calling a few times from her BlackBerry as she drove out here, all but killing what's left of the battery. Maybe Carla's screening calls. Maybe she won't answer the door, either. You have to at least try, Lucinda tells herself. You drove all this way. You have to make sure she's okay. If she is, you have to warn her. And if she's not... She shakes her head and grimly climbs out of the car. She stoops to pick up the newspapers and tucks them under her arm as she walks up to the door, head bent against a stiff northeasterly wind. This is crazy. What is she doing here? There's no going back now, though. For all she knows, Carla is inside, watching her through the window. God, I hope so. She steps onto the black rubber mat with its nearly worn welcome stamp in white block letters. Taking a deep breath, she pushes the doorbell and waits for the reassuring sound of footsteps on the other side of the door. All is still. Too still. Eerily still. He followed her all the way to Manahawkin, stopping just short of the causeway leading to Long Beach Island. That's where she was headed, though. He watched her car until it disappeared into the island mist. Incredible. His little test proved that it really does work, like she said that day on television. Psychometry, it's called. He's been researching it. But he can't say that he was much of a believer until now. Bravo. Very impressive, Lucinda. It will be interesting to see what else your magic powers tell you. With his binoculars trained on her kitchen window, he watched her find Carla Barraquette's blood-caked signet ring where he'd left it in her coffee pot, knowing she wouldn't miss it there. The first thing Lucinda does every morning is attend to her caffeine addiction. She must have seen something when she touched that ring, or felt something, or whatever it is that happens when a psychic touches a dead person's belonging. His first inkling that his experiment might have been a success was the look on her face when she held that ring with her eyes closed. Then she snapped into action. She made a quick phone call. To whom? Then threw on her clothes and headed for the door, leaving him barely enough time to scramble to follow her. Having anticipated that she might do just that, he had a rental car ready and waiting around the corner. He'd considered simply borrowing a vehicle from an unsuspecting owner to avoid the hassle and expense, but the last thing he needs is to be chased down by a cop on the lookout for a stolen plate. Personally, he doesn't care much for surprises, pleasant or otherwise. When it comes to surprising others, though, he's in his element. What better feeling is there than to see all of his laborious manipulations come to fruition in an instant? Wide-eyed shock blasting across a woman's face when she realizes she's not alone, after all. Once, though, the tables were turned on him. He'll never forget the night that his mother came walking in the door when she should have been at work, and found him washing Judy Steinberg's blood from his hands. He didn't hear Mother come in. "What have you done?" she began shrieking, out of nowhere. Regrettably, his reaction to that little surprise had cost his mother her life, and ultimately cost him 35 years of his. So no, he doesn't appreciate being blindsided by a woman. Not when he spent months of his time and energy planning and executing every intricate step, having anticipated every possible obstacle, every loophole. That's the beauty of studying a woman's routine the way he has Lucinda's and Carla's and others before them. Where once, so very long ago, he did it just for voyeuristic pleasure, now his surveillance is an important tool to be used in gaining total control. If he can anticipate a woman's movements and reactions in any given situation on any given day, he can manipulate her like a human puppet, oblivious to its own strings. Seeing Lucinda Sloane barreling toward Beach Haven on this ugly Tuesday morning has been enormously satisfying. Here is the proof that he's gained the ultimate control over her, manipulating not just her surroundings and her movements, but her thoughts themselves. What lies ahead is going to be far more rewarding than he ever imagined. Lucinda rings the bell again, fearing that it's too late. Damn it. Damn it, damn it. Damn it. Lucinda rests her forehead against the barricade's front door, waiting in vain. You should have told Randy what was going on when you spoke to him earlier. She'd been about to, but she stopped herself. She couldn't bring herself to do that to him, not with him helpless all the way on the other side of the country. He's familiar enough with Lucinda and her visions to have been thrown into a panic if she called out of the blue to tell him she'd had one involving his wife. Come on. That's not the only reason you didn't tell him, and you know it. Okay. Maybe she was worried that he'd think she was making up stuff about Carla because of her lingering feelings for him. Or worse yet, maybe she thought he'd believe the vision had been real, but that it had stemmed from her subconscious jealousy of his wife. From wishful thinking. Maybe I believed that, too. Did she really want something horrible to happen to Carla? Of course not. Not consciously, anyway. Riddled with more unaccustomed guilt, she didn't call Neil to tell him about the disturbing vision, or that she was driving out here, or about the ring. Nor did she call the Long Beach Township Police Department to have them check on Carla. How could she? Randy's colleagues there would have been on the phone to him in a heartbeat, telling them some woman was worried something might have happened to his wife. Whatever. Now I just need to make sure that Carla is okay. Go home and get myself into therapy. She never resorted to that in the past, but if her subconscious mind is killing off her ex-lover's wife, She definitely needs help. Still, a dark cloud hangs over the Barakat residence like a funeral shroud, and Lucinda suspects that it has nothing to do with her and her forbidden feelings for Carla's husband. She should leave. She should call the township police despite Randy's connection to them. She should go home and call Neil and tell him about the strange signet ring. She should do a lot of things. Story of her life. But she doesn't. What Lucinda does is reach for the knob and turn it, tentatively. It's locked, of course. After all that happened here in Beach Haven last summer, did she really expect anything different? Now what? At a loss, she looks around, then down at the worn welcome beneath her feet. Nah. After a moment, though, she stoops to lift the rubber corner. It would be so easy, too easy, if... There it is. Stunned, she pulls a house key from beneath the mat. After all that happened here in Beach Haven? How could you let your guard down like this? She scolds Carla and Randy. Particularly Randy. He's a cop. He worked the local case. He, of all people, knows that evil can dwell where you least expect it. As she puts the key into the lock, she sees a fleeting image of another hand turning it. A man's hand, wearing a black glove. Trembling, Lucinda turns the key. Oh, Carla, please be okay. Please don't be dead. Why did you hide the damned key under the doormat? The island has always been a safe place, and with last summer's killer no longer on the loose, is it any wonder the locals have been lulled into a false sense of security? False? Can you really blame them? What are the chances that lightning will strike twice in the same place? Lucinda sucks in her breath and opens the door, then steps gingerly over the threshold. The house is warm and still. This isn't good. She can feel it. She exhales shakily, and when she breathes in again, she knows. The putrid miasma of death chokes the overheated air. Gagging, she hurtles herself back out into the cold, fumbling blindly in her pocket for her BlackBerry. As he follows the highway back west toward Philadelphia, his mind is on what lies ahead, packing and making the other necessary preparations for his trip. It's time to take this show on the road. Still, he really was tempted to follow Lucinda the rest of the way out to the island. How he'd have loved to see her make an entrance on his carefully dressed scene, to hear her protesting her innocence, even as the police collect evidence that will indicate otherwise. But for now, much as he'd love to be there to watch the drama unfold from a nice, secluded seat in the wings, he has to keep his distance. He doesn't dare take a chance. Not with the police and Lucinda the psychic on the scene. All it would take is for someone to spot him and... Curtains for you, old boy. Wouldn't that be a shame? After all the trouble he took with props, not to mention makeup. He's been setting the stage for months. Months? Years, really. All those years spent in a 6x9 concrete cell with nothing to do but think and remember and plan. He emerged from prison ripe for action, and then Lucinda Sloane popped up on his television set with those red, red lips, and there was Ava Neary. Ava Neary. And he knew it was meant to be. Why? Carla Barakat asked him over and over, sobbing hysterically. Why are you doing this to me? The last two words were key. To me. She didn't ask, as investigators had all those years ago when they were trying to determine whether he was competent to stand trial, why he felt the need to kill. She asked why he was killing her. Caught up in the pleasure of carrying out the long-planned execution, he didn't bother to explain that she was no random victim, that he simply had no choice. She had to die in order to set the plan in motion. He probably should have told her. Even a condemned prisoner on death row is officially informed of the reason for his sentence. It's only fair. Carla Barakat went to her death without realizing her sentence had been set the August day he, and the rest of the world, saw the unmistakable connection between her husband and Lucinda Sloan. Ah, well, he won't make that mistake with the next one. He'll tell her exactly why she has to die, if she asks. It's only fair. But first, he has to find her. Hearing the rumble of the mail truck on the street, Vic hits save, leans back from the keyboard, and stretches. Break time. He picks up his long empty coffee cup and brings it to the kitchen, leaving it in the sink with the breakfast dishes. Today he'll try to empty the dishwasher and reload it before Kitty gets home. Yesterday he lost track of time. It's okay, she said, wiping waffle crumbs off the counter at 7 o'clock last night, still wearing her suit and pumps from the office. You're on a deadline. God, he loves his wife. She's going to be so proud when his book comes out. His publisher is already talking about sending him on a book tour, newspaper interviews, television appearances, store signings. That will be exciting. It would be even more exciting if he could do all of that as a hero, with the night watchman behind bars at last. For all he knows, the unsub is already there, or died 35 years ago. It would be nice to know. Nice? It would be the culmination of his life's work, and one hell of an epilogue. Vic opens the front door as the red, white, and blue postal truck rolls toward his driveway. The yard and tree branches are blanketed in a feathery coating of white, the driveway marred by a pair of dusted-over tire tracks from Kitty's car. He didn't even notice that it had snowed.
Sorry it's not shoveled,
he calls to Smitty, the mailman, as he heads up the walk carrying a bundle of letters.
Guess I better get to it. You're a rich book author now,
Smitty replies with a grin. He, like everyone else in the world, saw the articles written about Vic and the Night Watchman case when the Associated Press picked up on the publisher's press release.
Get someone else to do the dirty work.
Vic doesn't tell him he has yet to receive the advance, and that it will hardly make him rich when he does get it. With any luck, though, the amended contract will be in today's mail. His agent said she sent it to him for his signature before the long weekend.
How's the book coming along?
Smitty asks, handing over the mail. It's coming along, Vic breathes white puffs of frigid air.
Well, get back to it. See you later.
With a wave, Smitty is on his way. Vic shuts out the cold and carries the mail back toward the kitchen, stopping to turn up the thermostat. He probably shouldn't, oil prices being what they are this winter. But who knows? Maybe once the book comes out, he really will be a rich author. His agent is trying to negotiate movie rights.
It might be an easier sell if they'd caught the guy, she told him.
Like Helter Skelter. But there's a certain marketable mystique to this killer still being out there, walking among us. The guy who wrote about the Zodiac got a major movie deal out of it. Wouldn't that be something? Vic and Kitty have gotten a lot of mileage out of fantasizing about who might play them on film. I think Brad Pitt should play you, she told Vic, who snorted.
He's too young,
he added dryly, and not good-looking enough. He's not playing you as you are now, she pointed out. He's playing you in the past when you were on the case. You were young then. Right. Yet another reminder that nothing of note has happened on the case since. Vic couldn't care less about marketable mystique. He doesn't want to cash in on the fact that the killer might still be out there, walking among them. But when he said that to his agent, she told him to leave the business end of things to her. Sitting at the kitchen table, he pushes aside the dirty breakfast plates and utensils and goes through the mail. No contract today. There's a brochure from Norwegian Cruise Lines, courtesy of Dave Goodlow, who's been trying to convince Vic that he and Kitty would love cruising. Vic said he'd think about it, but that was back before the book. Now he's got better things to do than sail around, learning to salsa dance or playing bingo or eating at buffets or whatever it is that people do on cruises. He puts the brochure aside. Beneath it is a legal-sized white envelope addressed to Victor Shattuck, FBI agent. The label is typewritten, and the envelope was postmarked in New York City without a return address. Vic picks up a butter knife from the table, wipes the greasy toast crumbs from the blade, and uses it as a letter opener. He removes a single sheet of paper, unfolds it. Two words are written in the center of the page in what looks like red lipstick. I'm back. Chapter 5. Huddled tearfully on the welcome mat, still clutching the Bearcat's newspapers, Lucinda has no idea how much time has passed before a squad car comes wailing up to the house. Probably only a few minutes, but it feels like hours since she called 911. The sea air seems infused with the stench of rotting flesh and her own vomit wafting up from the shrubs beside the steps. It has taken every ounce of her strength to stay here, waiting for the authorities. Now, thank God, they're here. She wipes her eyes on her sleeve, vaguely recognizing one of the two uniformed officers who dash from the car. The male, who looks exactly like Harry Potter, minus the forehead lightning bolt, was around police headquarters last summer. Randy introduced him to Lucinda then, but she can't remember his name. With him is a stocky, blonde female officer Lucinda's never seen before. But now isn't the time for introductions or reintroductions. "Look in the bathroom," Lucinda instructs them, then buries her face in a trembling hand as they hurry past her into the house. Alone again, she forces herself to stay calm, to keep breathing, to stay here on the scene. "You can do this. You can see it through. You've done it before. So many times before." In her line of work, death scenes are inevitable. But she isn't working, and this time death has struck too close to home. Oh, Randy. He's going to be devastated. How could this have happened? The thought that's been flitting through her traumatized brain settles at last. What if this has something to do with that scrapbook filled with dead women? Did Carla's killer leave it for Lucinda and then snatch it away? And the signet ring she wrapped with care and locked in her glove compartment, could it have been Carla's after all, covered in Carla's blood? Lucinda darts a wary glance around at the yard, the neighboring houses, the street. Everything seems deserted. But that doesn't mean he's not here even now, watching her. He? It could be a she. No. It's not. She doesn't know how she's so sure about that, but she is. Her own intuition? Or is it because of Maeve's scary man? Maybe a bit of both. The door opens behind her, and she looks up to see the female officer step out of the house, looking green. The woman gulps some air. "Are you all right?" Lucinda asks. "Absolutely." But when she rakes a hand through her stubbly blonde hair, Lucinda sees that it's shaking. She's probably new on the force, not used to dead bodies. Not like me. Yet, does one ever really get used to the smell of death, or the sight of it? Thank God she didn't have to see Carla. Not in person, anyway. It's bad enough to have glimpsed the bloody scene in her vision. "Is she dead?" she asks the cop, but the words clog in her throat, barely emerging a whisper. "My partner's trying to locate the next of kin." Next of kin. Randy. She can't speak. "I'm Sergeant Van Aken, ma'am, and I'm going to need some information from you." Numb, Lucinda nods. Of course. She's a witness. A witness who has no idea what's going on. She watches the female officer stride to the squad car. Again, Lucinda thinks about the scrapbook, wonders if there can possibly be a connection. The scrapbook, the piece of paper, the ring. It doesn't make sense.
It does make sense.
Oh, hell, she can't even think straight.
Sergeant Van Aken returns with a clipboard, her radio squawking at her hip.
It's her partner's voice, Lucinda realizes, hearing Randy's address. The officer inside the house is radioing for backup.
Got a 1054 here, he's saying.
And of course, Lucinda knows the code. 1054. Possible dead body.
Were you a friend of the victim's, ma'am?
I'm a friend of her husband's. Sort of. I mean, I know him.
Someone has to tell Randy, she thinks dully, and wonders who's going to do it, and when, and how, as the officer writes down her name, address, age, and other statistics Lucinda is able to provide with robotic precision. Then Sergeant Van Aken asks,
"So you drove all the way out here from Philadelphia to visit?"
Lucinda's autopilot shuts off abruptly. She hesitates, conscious of the woman's steely gaze fixed on her face.
How the hell is she supposed to explain her presence here? Should she tell her about the ring and the vision? But that's so complicated.
Miss Sloan?
Yes, I came to see Randy, she hears herself say, and immediately regrets it. Randy is in Lake Tahoe. If they check her phone records, they'll see that she called him this morning, and it'll be pretty obvious that she knew he wouldn't be home.
Why would they check my phone records, though? I'm not a suspect.
She shifts her weight uneasily, realizing what Sergeant Van Aken is thinking. I need Randy here to set her straight. Or Neil. I don't know how to answer these questions without making myself look suspicious.
What was the purpose for your visit here, Miss Sloan?
Just to say hello. Knowing enough not to elaborate, she bites down on her bottom lip and waits for the next question.
And you had a key to the house?
No, I... She looks up, sees the key still sticking out of the lock where she left it. I found it under the doormat, I swear. The officer who had started to write that down looks up sharply at her last words.
Why do you say that?
What?
I swear. It sounds like you're trying to convince me that you found the key under the mat. Why wouldn't I believe you?
Because, I mean, a key under the mat?
A lot of people hide keys under the mat.
I know, that's why... Never mind. She mutters uneasily and shifts a nervous gaze back toward the house, wishing Harry Potter would come out and vouch for her. If he even remembers her, that is. But of course he must. It's not every day that a police psychic blows into town to help solve a missing persons case.
So, Ms. Sloan, let's recap. You got here, you opened the door with the key, you went into the house, and then what?
Then I called 911.
You found Mrs. Barakat and you called 911?
No, I didn't find her. I called 911 and then...
Without seeing the victim?
She nods. It smelled like... I mean, I knew when I walked in. So I came back out and I called. The officer writes that down.
Just to be clear, then, you called without seeing Mrs. Barakat.
That's what I said. Watch it, Lucinda. Don't get prickly. That won't help, and she's just doing her job.
And what exactly did you do while you were in the house?
Nothing, she says promptly, defensively. I was barely in the house. I didn't get more than a step or two past the front door. Sergeant Van Aken digests this.
Have you ever been in the house before?
No, never.
Not in the past?
That's what before means, isn't it?
Never, Lucinda bites out.
And not today?
Never.
Yet when Detective Lambert and I arrived, you told us to look in the bathroom, correct?
Lucinda curses silently and fights the urge to close her eyes or look up at the sky, instead fastening her gaze on the police officers.
Yes, she says simply, That's what I told you.
And you knew this because?
Because I'm a psychic. The woman waits, apparently, for a more acceptable answer, thinking Lucinda is some kind of wise-ass. Happens all the time. But usually, the stakes aren't this high. A gust of salty wet wind blows her long auburn curls across her face. As she rakes a restless hand through her hair, she does her best not to look longingly at her car. She's not going anywhere. She's got to be here for Randy when he arrives. Forget their past. Forget her vow to keep her distance. He's going to need all the support he can get.
Sergeant Van Aken clears her throat. Miss Sloan, I asked how you found the victim if you hadn't been inside the house.
I know you did, and I answered you.
She swallows the ache in her throat and repeats wearily.
I knew because I'm a psychic. Look, it's true. You can ask your partner.
Excuse me?
I met him, she gestures at the house. Last summer. They know me on the force. Seriously, ask your partner, Detective Lambert, is it, to come out here, or, you know what, just ask Randy Barricat. He'll explain.
Belatedly, she realizes the absurdity of that suggestion. Explaining Lucinda's psychic abilities is going to be the last thing on Randy's agenda when the Beach Haven police reach him.
Poor Randy, she thinks again.
Noting the suspicion in Sergeant Van Aken's eyes, she thinks,
and poor me.
Sergeant Van Aken still looks a little pale, obviously not over what she found in the house.
All at once, Lucinda realizes something. Fresh corpses don't smell. It takes at least a day or two before putrefaction starts to set in, bringing with it the stench of rotting flesh.
But when she reached Randy this morning, he said he'd spoken to Carla last night.
Obviously, he was lying.
Why? Sitting in construction traffic outside Winslow, he turns on the radio to look for a local station, wondering if there will be any news on the discovery of a body in Beach Haven. Nothing but music.
Music. That reminds him.
He smiles, wondering whether Lucinda has found the little serenade he left on her iPod yet. Fat, wet snowflakes begin to plop onto the windshield. Pity, he thinks, as he flicks on the wipers, that he's not headed for a warmer climate at this time of year. But there is no room for deviation in this plan. He's painstakingly laid out every step in advance, and of course knows exactly where and when he'll make his next appearance. Soon enough, if she's as smart as he thinks she is, so will Lucinda Sloan. That, for him, is the very best part. In fact, maybe he'll make a little detour now that he knows she's not home, give her another little clue to keep her guessing. Sooner or later, she's bound to figure it out. And when she does, the fun will really begin. He laughs, just thinking about it. Laughs good and long and hard. Laughs until his sides hurt and the traffic begins to move again, and he can barely see to drive. Lucinda, of course I remember you. Summoned to the front steps by Sergeant Van Aken, Detective Dan Lambert nods. You're Randy's friend. That's what she told me. Van Aken informs him, as yet another investigator, this one carrying photography equipment, hurries past them and into the house. I just wanted to double-check because, well, you know.
Yes, Lambert knows, and so does Lucinda, who was rapidly being made to feel like a suspect in the murder of Carla Barricat.
Lucinda is the psychic detective who helped out on the case last summer, before you got here. Lambert tells Van Aken. The case. No need to specify which one on an island where the police spend far more time handing out parking tickets than investigating abductions and homicides.
Psychic? Detective?
Van Aken slants a bushy blonde eyebrow at Lucinda.
You didn't say you were a detective.
There are a lot of things Lucinda didn't say.
You're based out of Philadelphia, right? Lambert asks.
Yes.
And what was it again that brought you here? He asks, as though he and Lucinda have already discussed the situation.
They haven't.
But she has a feeling he and Van Aken have.
I had a vision, she says simply. It made me worry about Carla.
She said that's how she knew to find the victim in the bathroom, Van Aken puts in. Lucinda notices that even with Lambert here to back up Lucinda's psychic background, the female cop doesn't seem entirely convinced of her abilities. Most people are skeptical upon meeting her and hearing what she does. That's typically the least of Lucinda's worries. Not today. Not as the only witness at the murder scene of her ex-lover's wife.
Look, someone left a ring in my kitchen, and I found it this morning, she tells Lambert and Van Aken as a couple of paramedics exit the house and brush past, carrying unused equipment back to their van.
A ring? As in jewelry?
Yes, and it was coated in something that looked to me like dried blood. The two cops look at each other.
Did you call the police when you found it?
No. When I picked it up, I connected it to Carla right away.
It was her ring?
I don't know. I didn't think so. It was a signet, but the initial was wrong. It was a Z.
Lambert's eyes widen behind his oval glasses.
That was Carla's ring. I've seen it. She wore it all the time. It used to belong to her mother.
Her mother, of course. Zelda. Lucinda feels as though someone just vacuumed the air out of her lungs. If it was Carla's ring, covered in Carla's blood, then it had to have been left in Lucinda's apartment by Carla's killer.
Why didn't you call the police when you found this bloody ring and had this disturbing vision about Mrs. Barricat?
She can't tell Lambert that she didn't trust herself, that she thought her subconsciousness might have conjured the image of Carla, dead, out of some deep-seated resentment. How can she admit that to anyone, especially a friend of Randy's, especially now?
You are a fool, Lucinda. You're always a fool where Randy is concerned. You let your feelings get in the way of sound judgment. How could you?
It's so obvious in retrospect that she did everything wrong, from not calling the police to her careless handling of the evidence. Lucinda, Lambert prods, now watching her nearly as warily as Van Aken has been all along.
I called Randy, she tells them. But when I found out he was away, I didn't want to alarm him.
Did you say anything at all to him about his wife?
I asked him when he last talked to her, and he said last night. Oh, Randy, why did you lie about that? What are you hiding?
Not really, she tells his colleagues. I decided to come on over here and see if everything was okay.
Come on over, as if it's right around the corner.
Where is the ring right now? Lambert asks.
In a plastic bag in my glove compartment.
A plastic bag, all right, good. He gives her a little nod of approval. Van Aken, less approving, asks, did you wear gloves when you handled it?
No, she admits. Not the first time, not until I realized what it might be. My prints will be on it.
Lambert is already walking toward her car. With any luck, so will someone else's. Twilight is falling by the time Neil Bullard arrives at the Long Beach Township Police Headquarters on Long Beach Boulevard. Never in her life has Lucinda been so glad to see anyone. Being a man of few words, particularly over the telephone, Neil didn't say much when she reached him earlier with the news. He told her he was just leaving Scranton and promised to get to her as quickly as possible. He also asked if she knew whether an investigator named Frank Santiago was on the case.
I think so. Why? Do you know him?
I did, a long time ago.
Neil didn't elaborate. She didn't expect him to. He did ask her how she'd come to be on Long Beach Island.
Long story, she told him. I'll tell you when you get here.
Grateful to see him at last, She rises from her chair as Neil strides past the desk sergeant, who looks up only briefly before going back to a phone call.
I'm so glad you're here.
I was just going to say that to you.
He gives her a swift, hard hug.
I've been trying to call your cell. I thought maybe you'd left.
Where would I go? The battery died after I called you. She sinks into her chair again, facing the beach buggy permit sign she's read and reread for hours now, brooding about Randy.
Are there still reporters out front?
She asks Neil.
What do you think?
He sits beside her, stretching his long legs in front of him. He's wearing jeans and sneakers. He really didn't waste a moment's time getting here.
Does the press know you're involved?
I don't think so.
They're going to have a field day when they find out.
Maybe they won't.
Have a field day? Are you kidding?
I meant maybe they won't find out.
You're kidding, right?
She sighs and shakes her head.
Oh, I bought this for you when I stopped for gas.
Neil pulls something out of his pocket.
Thank you.
She gladly accepts the jumbo-sized Twix bar, surprised by the lump of emotion in her throat. Neil takes care of her, even when she doesn't think that she wants or needs to be taken care of, which is pretty much always.
I figured you might be hungry.
She is hungry, she realizes, though she hadn't even noticed until this very moment. Aside from the Pepsi and coffee she gulped down before hitting the road, she hasn't had a thing to drink, much less eat, all day. He watches her take a huge bite of chocolate-coated caramel, and then another.
So is Randy?
He's on his way.
Again, she thinks about Randy's lie, and the candy bar turns sodden in her mouth. But she can't tell Neil. She can't tell anyone. Not without at least talking to Randy first.
How is he?
Neil asks. I don't know. I tried calling his cell phone again before mine died, and there was no answer. Maybe he's on a plane.
What time is he getting in?
She shrugs. All I know is that someone called him. I heard them say that he was going to catch the first plane back. But he's out in Tahoe. I don't even know if there's an airport there.
Reno. He'll have to drive there, or maybe Sacramento, and make a connection.
How do you know that? She asks, having often heard Neil's claim that he's never been west of Pennsylvania.
Patty and Jeff went skiing at Squaw Valley a few years ago, and they left the twins with us. Maeve ended up in the ER with pneumonia, and they had a hell of a time getting back. Randy will be lucky if he gets here before tomorrow.
I figured it would be a while.
You're not planning to wait all night, are you, Sin?
If that's what it takes, I want to be here for him.
He gives her a long look. No matter what happened between us in the past, and no matter what reason he had for lying to me this morning, Randy's my friend. How can I walk out on him now?
Neil says nothing to that, asking instead,
Did you get any more information on what happened to Carla?
I have no idea. Nobody's telling me any of the details.
Did they at least mention whether there are any suspects?
Just me.
Neil's green eyes widen.
Well, not really, she says quickly. Not anymore, anyway.
She explains about the ring, and how she came to be here, and what happened back at Randy's house. She keeps her voice low, even though they're the only two people sitting here. The desk sergeant has his hands full with incessantly ringing phones. The press has clearly gotten wind of another murder on the quiet little island.
You should have called me the second you found that ring,
Neil tells her, just as she'd known he would.
I should have done a lot of things. I'm sorry. I hadn't slept much and I wasn't thinking straight. I don't think I am even now.
She sighs, rubs her eyes, exhausted.
I don't suppose you bought me some coffee at that gas station, did you?
Sorry, I should have. Let's go out and find a diner or something.
What about the press out there?
You'll have to leave sooner or later. Maybe there's a back door.
What if Randy shows up?
He won't. Not yet. Come on, I'll buy you dinner, and then we'll come right back.
She hesitates. Okay. Standing, she tosses the candy bar wrapper into the trash can, then picks up her coat. Several blue plastic bags drop from the folds onto the floor.
What are those?
The Barricat's newspapers, she tells Neil, gathering them. I picked them up from the driveway when I got there, and I forgot I had them. She starts to throw them into the trash, but Neil stops her.
If we're going to sit here all night, I'll read them.
Old news?
Not the news, but I'll take all the sports sections. You can throw the rest of it away. I missed the last few Sixers games because I had the kids with me, so I've got to catch up.
Neil, a rabid basketball fan, holds out his hand. Lucinda takes the papers out of their protective plastic bags and begins sorting through the sections. Something flutters to the floor. Neil bends to pick it up as she separates yesterday's sports page from the rest of the paper.
Sin?
Mm-hmm. He doesn't reply. She looks up to see him holding up a white sheet of paper. Typed precisely in the middle of the page, in bold black type, are two numbers. 87.7, 41.9. Chapter 6.
Morning, Joe.
Night, Larry.
Both men smile as they pass each other with their usual greeting. Larry Blazer carrying a janitor's bucket and mop, ready to erase the sticky remains of another night at the bar. Joe Armano, with a down jacket thrown over his dress shirt and loosened tie, car keys in hand, heading home after the closing shift. If he's lucky, he'll get home in time to kiss his wife, Mary Lou, hello and goodbye, as she leaves to start her early morning nursing shift at Methodist Hospital. Sometimes he catches her, sometimes he doesn't. It all depends on how many times she hits the snooze button on the alarm. She works hard, Mary Lou. So does he. With two sons in college and a daughter planning a wedding for June, they have no choice. After being forced into early retirement from his job as a telecommunications manager and cheated out of 10% of his pension, Joe has no choice but to do what he can to make ends meet. He likes bartending better than his other current job, driving for an airport car service. Drunken revelers tip a lot better than harried businessmen on ever leaner corporate expense accounts. Any other time of day, the streets are buzzing in the Rittenhouse Square area, filling with people coming and going from upscale restaurants, expensive shops, fancy hotels, and apartment buildings. At this hour, though, even the club kids have gone home, and with freezing temperatures and sunup still a few hours off, all is quiet. Joe's footsteps sound hollow as he walks the familiar route up South 18th Street toward the garage off Market Street, where he pays a small fortune to park his car every night. He parked on the street when he first started working down here, but after a few tickets and a few break-ins, he wised up. Not that the streets around here aren't safe, but you leave a decent-looking BMW, even the older model used one that Mary Lou fondly continues to call his midlife crisis splurge years later, on the street anywhere in the wee hours, and you're going to see some damage. Damn, it's cold tonight. Joe crosses against the light, not a car in sight, and starts up the next block, where a couple of older storefronts hug the sidewalk. Someone steps from the sheltered doorway of one of them, directly into his path, facing him. Startled, Joe stops walking and prays that the man is bundled in a parka zipped to his nose and a ski cap pulled low over his eyes because of the temperature. If not, Joe wonders if he can fight him off and run. The guy is the same height as he is and looks about the same weight, though it's hard to tell with the bulk of the parka. But Joe used to be a wrestler. He's still strong, and he knows some moves. He sees the gun, and his guts go liquid.
Give me your wallet.
Joe's gloved hand, trembling, goes to the back pocket of the nice gray dress pants Mary Lou gave him for Christmas saying he needed to dress more fashionably if he was going to work at an upscale bar near Rittenhouse. He hands over his wallet. The mugger, wearing black leather gloves, opens it and looks inside.
Take it. You can have whatever's in it. Just don't hurt me, please.
The mugger gives a nod as if he's satisfied, snaps the wallet closed, and tucks it into his pocket.
Sorry, Joe,
are the last words Joe Armano hears before his brains are blown out. Miss Sloan? She looks up to see the young cop who's been working the desk phones since beginning last night's late shift.
Yes.
Would you like one?
He offers a box of Krispy Kremes, adding, I know what you're thinking, cops and donuts. Cliché, right?
Clichés are clichés because they're true.
She manages a faint smile and gratefully accepts a glazed jelly donut. He returns to his post, and she devours it in two bites, wishing she'd taken two. She hasn't eaten a thing since the Twix bar Neil brought her last night, right before they found the paper bearing the strange numerical sequence. They immediately turned it over to the police, along with the newspapers and plastic bags.
Which newspaper was this with?
Was, of course, one of the first questions from the detectives who came on duty when Lambert and Van Aken went off. Her answer? I'm not sure. Was hardly satisfactory. Another strike against Lucinda with a fresh crop of Long Beach Township investigators. She should have given Lambert and Van Aken the newspapers in the first place yesterday, but it never occurred to her that, beyond the ring, she was harboring evidence from a crime scene.
It should have. You're not exactly new to this, yet somehow you've bungled one thing after another.
In her defense, as Neil pointed out to the police, she was upset and tired, and anyway, hindsight is 20/20. How could she have guessed that Carla's killer might have left a clue with the newspaper?
How indeed.
She gathered the papers, carried them away. In the grand scheme of things, that wouldn't exactly be second nature. She's pretty sure that was no accident.
No, because her brain is wired to pick up on things most people don't.
She was subconsciously drawn to those newspapers because she herself has some oblique connection to Carla's killer, the most frightening prospect of all.
Is there any way this note wasn't in with the papers when you picked them up off the driveway?
Neil asked her last night, on the heels of their discovery.
What do you mean?
I mean, maybe someone is following you and left it in the newspaper after you picked it up. Did you let the papers out of your sight for even a moment today?
I forgot I even had them with me.
Her nerves were fraying fast at that point, thanks to exhaustion, low blood sugar, and though she would never admit it to anyone but herself, sheer fright.
I probably left them here with my coat a couple of times when I went to the ladies' room.
So anyone could have come in and left this note?
I guess so. But would someone really do that in a police station?
Probably not. In the end, both she and Neil concluded that the killer had probably left the note at the scene of the crime, that he was the same person who left the album and the ring in her apartment, and that he might have something to do with Ava Neary's death as well. The Long Beach Township police didn't seem as convinced. They asked to see the other sheet of paper, which was back at Neil's house. He left after midnight to drive back to Philadelphia to get it and to meet a couple of other detectives from the Philadelphia Police Department at her apartment to dust for prints.
I should go with you, she said,
but he shook his head immediately.
You're safer here.
On an island with a murderer on the loose?
In the police station on an island far away from your apartment, which, let's not forget, he visited after the murder to leave the bloody souvenir. I'd be surprised if he's hanging around Beach Haven now, but we might be able to pick up the trail in Philly.
Neil was right, of course. Anyway, she wanted to wait for word about Randy. She spent the night mostly staring into space, but occasionally dozing into a fitful sleep, dogged by the familiar unfinished puzzle dream. Now, glancing toward the glass doors, she sees that it's still dark outside. The sun should be coming up soon, though. It's past 6 a.m. She stretches and stands. This time she takes her belongings with her when she goes to the restroom, hanging her coat and purse on a door hook as she splashes some cold water on her face. Looking into the mirror above the sink, she sees blatant evidence of two sleepless nights and a murder in between. Beyond the predictable dark circles around her eyes, her wavy hair is out of control. Her skin is dry and her lips are cracked from being exposed to the elements outside Randy's house yesterday. She checks her purse for something that might help. Lip balm, a comb, lotion, a barrette. Nope. She isn't the type to primp away from home. In her coat pocket, though, along with the iPod she forgot to remove the other night, she finds a stray rubber band. Not a coated hair elastic, but the plain old office supply kind, from the bundle of mail she took from her box when she returned from Curacao, she realizes. It'll have to do. She finger combs her curls the best she can, gathers them into a ponytail, then winces as she snaps the band around it, the rubber tugging painfully at a few strands. Better, though, she decides, looking into the mirror. Back in the waiting room, she returns to her lonely vigil. Remembering her iPod, she removes it from her pocket and inserts the white earbuds. Maybe music will make things a little brighter in this darkest hour before the dawn. Oh, who is she kidding? Even music isn't going to let her forget Carla's death for one instant. Still, what else has she got to do? As her thumb reaches to work the scroll wheel, Detective Lambert appears. Ms. Sloan? His gaze is solemn behind those storybook wizard glasses. She yanks out the earbuds. You can call me Lucinda. Lucinda, he nods. Randy's back home. He took a red eye. I told him you've been here all night. He wants to see you right away. A beach town in the off-season is the perfect place to commit a crime, Lucinda concludes as she turns onto Randy's deserted street a few blocks from the beach. There's no one around, really, to part the blinds and make note of a strange car prowling the street. No one would have heard terrified cries for help, even if the sound made it past the storm windows, even if the wind and surf didn't sweep them away. Still, someone, somewhere, might have seen something, heard something. Experience has taught Lucinda that someone usually does. A squad car sits again, or perhaps still, in front of Randy's house. Lucinda parks a few doors down and walks past the mostly deserted homes of the Barracat's neighbors, holding two cups of deli coffee balanced against her hip on a spongy beige cardboard carrier. One is laced with lots of sugar and half, the other black and unsweetened. She knows, of course, how Randy takes his coffee. They drank a lot of it together during those late-night investigations. Filmy sunlight has broken through the clouds. The wind off the ocean feels colder, though, than it did yesterday, permeating Lucinda's body and blowing her hair across her face. The strands tickle her cheeks, and she slaps at them like a joyless kitten pawing at dangling yarn. Randy's car, mud-spattered and coated with road salt, is parked behind Carla's in the driveway. Lucinda walks past it, approaching the Barracat's front door for the second time in 24 hours. A uniformed officer answers her knock. She recognizes him, having seen him around the station yesterday. He's considerably more friendly now that she's being admitted to the inner circle. Lucinda Sloan, right?
Yes.
Here, want a hand with the coffee?
No, thanks, I've got it.
Randy's waiting for you. He's in the kitchen. Go on in. It's that way. As she moves beyond the threshold, she can smell Lysol and bleach, but nothing more. The windows are cracked open. Randy's fellow officers must have worked to air out the house after Carla's body was moved to the morgue yesterday. Lucinda can't help but notice that the house isn't the charming dream house she imagined. A cursory glance as she moves through the living room and dining room shows that while the place is nicely furnished, mostly in blonde wood and beige upholstery, with a couple of pastel prints in metallic frames hanging on the walls, There are none of the little personal touches that make a house a home. She can't help but compare the place to Neil and Irma's, with its family photos, tchotchkes, and collections galore, or even to her own apartment, which feels a lot more lived in, even though she's alone and has only been there a month. So Randy and Carla aren't into stuff. So what? That doesn't mean this isn't a happy home. No, but it doesn't feel happy. Well, of course the house gives off a bad vibe. Carla died here. But it feels like there's more to it than that. Pausing in the kitchen doorway, she spots Randy and immediately curtails the little argument with her psychic self. He's sitting with his back to her, slumped forward with his head resting on his forearms, folded flat against the table. Lucinda watches him for a moment, a fist of regret squeezing her heart. He's a good guy, the best. He doesn't deserve this pain. What is he going to do now? How is he going to live with this? And why did he lie about the last time he'd spoken to Carla? What if... No, you know he didn't have anything to do with it. Of course he didn't. He couldn't have. But it's been such a long time. How well do you know him now? Frustrated by the track her thoughts are taking, she clears her throat. Randy. He lifts his head and turns, tears running down his sorrow-scoured face.
Somebody killed her, Lucinda. Somebody killed her.
It's a little boy wail, and it pierces her soul, sending her to his side. This is Randy. She knows him, trusts him. She blindly puts aside the hot coffee cups and bends over him, holding him, stroking his hair as he shudders and soaks her shoulder with tears. I'm sorry, she says, over and over. When the tide of despair begins to ebb, she finds her way into a chair, pulling it close beside his, an arm draped around his shoulder.
I can't believe she's dead. I have to go down to the morgue.
His voice breaks.
Can't someone else do that for you?
No, I have to do it because I just can't believe it.
I'm so sorry, Randy.
He nods, plucks a tissue from the box on the table, blows his nose. What more is there to say?
I know how hard this is. I know how much you loved her.
In the midst of crumpling the tissue, he glances up at Lucinda. Something flickers in his blue eyes, giving her pause. But then it's gone, and he slumps in his chair, shaking his head.
This can't be happening.
How many times has she heard those words from the families of doomed missing persons? Over time, the stunned disbelief gives way to grief and anger, and eventually, if their ordeal ends with the discovery of a body, which many do not, grim acceptance. All of those emotions abrade Randy's handsome face now, along with blatant exhaustion, and none of the hope families of missing persons struggle to keep alive until the end, should they be fortunate enough to find closure. Randy's journey was over before it began, and closure, the certainty that his wife will never come home again, brings no relief. Neil arrives at Lucinda's apartment before the detective team. Wearing rubber gloves, he pockets her keys and closes the door behind him, wiping the slush from his sneakers. As a detective, he's entered unoccupied homes on countless occasions, all in a day's work. Why, then, does this feel so wrong? Because I know her, and somehow I feel like I'm invading her privacy, even though this is a crime scene now. He looks around. The apartment has come a long way since he came with her to give it a second look on a blustery December day at her request.
I like it, but I'm not sure about it, she'd said. I need another opinion.
About the neighborhood?
God, no. About the place itself.
It's an old building, really old. He asked where it was, and when she told him the cross streets, he understood the God, no. As Philadelphia neighborhoods go, Society Hill is among the safest.
It's also the last place he'd expect Lucinda Sloane to settle. She's never liked to talk much about her past, but Neil knows she likes to keep some distance between herself and her blue blood roots. She always did, anyway. But maybe the older she gets, the more she feels the need to reconcile the past. Her mother, her father, Randy. Randy. Carla. Fresh shock courses through Neil. What the hell is going on? He walks into the living room looking for signs of an intruder. There are none that he can see, but how would he know? He's only been here once before, on that first day before she moved in.
The apartment is great,
Neil told Lucinda after a walkthrough and a cursory inspection of the pipes and the outlets.
I just have one question. Why here?
You mean this neighborhood?
I mean this neighborhood.
She shrugged. It's convenient, and it's nice, and it's affordable. Why not?
The next thing I know, you'll be calling your mother for lunch.
He winked at her, and she gave him the finger. He's never met her parents, but he's heard of them even before he met Lucinda. Who hadn't? Charity golf events, black tie fundraisers, on the board of this and that foundation. Bitsy and Rudolph Sloane and their forebears have long been fixtures in Philadelphia society. Back when Neil first encountered their daughter, fresh from her parents' home, or clutches, as Lucinda preferred to phrase it, she bore the remnants of what struck him as adolescent rebelliousness. Not only that, but she was full of crap, or so he believed. A staunch Irish Catholic, he was predisposed to skepticism